Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of like absolute clinical precision.
Right, it feels very black and white, like engineering.
Exactly. You break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line on the glowing screen, and the doctor just points a pen at it and says, yep, there it is. That's end of the problem.
It's completely tangible.
But then you look at something like elite sports, specifically hockey, and we use this highly technical sounding term called hockey IQ.
Or people just call it vision.
Right, vision.
Yeah.
And imagine watching an elite center who seems to have, I mean, literal eyes in the back of their head.
They always make the perfect tape-to-tape pass-through traffic.
Yeah, they never seem rushed. Even when three guys are heavily forechecking them, they effortlessly dodge these massive bone-crushing hits.
And we watch them do this, and we treat it like it's some sort of magical gift.
We really do. We talk about it as if they were just born with this mutated, superior kind of brain that processes time totally differently than the rest of us.
It is entirely treated as a binary. The prevailing culture in sports is that, well, you either have the gift of vision or you just don't.
Like you're Wayne Gretzky or you're a grinder.
Exactly. And honestly, it is very comforting to think of it that way because it absolves the rest of us.
Oh, because if it's a gift, you can't be blamed for not having it.
Precisely. If we categorize vision as an innate mystical talent, it means we don't have to do the grueling work of figuring out how to learn it or how to teach it. It just becomes an excuse.
But what if that x-ray machine isn't actually broken when we try to look at hockey sense? What if we were just looking at the wrong part of the scan?
That is the million-dollar question.
And that is exactly what we are deconstructing today in this deep dive. We are taking that myth of the magical gift of hockey sense and shattering it.
We really are.
We're going to break down vision into trainable mechanical habits of observation and anticipation. And we are pulling the architecture for this from an incredibly detailed playbook called Scanning and Anticipation, Learning to Play the Game.
It's an amazing source.
It really is. If you want to understand how the greatest minds on the ice actually process the chaos of a game, we're going to build that mental model for you right now.
And the absolute core belief we have to establish before we take a single step forward is this: vision is not a gift, it is a habit of looking early.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because that is a massive statement. Vision is a habit of looking early.
It is the cornerstone of everything we are about to discuss. To build this model, we have to pull apart the actual physical mechanics of what a player does with their eyes, and crucially, their neck, before the puck ever touches their stick.
Right, because when you hear commentators marvel at a player who seems to see the whole ice, the secret behind that magic is almost laughably simple.
They already looked.
They already looked. They looked at a moment when the puck was 50 feet away.
And more importantly, they looked when nobody in the arena was paying attention to them. The looking happens before the puck arrives.
So let's get into the literal anatomy of that look, because the source material is very strict about this. We throw around the word scan constantly in hockey. Like, oh, he scanned the ice.
But doing it incorrectly is incredibly common.
Yeah, from what I'm reading here, a true scan is a literal physical head turn. It is not just shifting your eyes to the corner of your socket.
No, not at all.
It is not slightly dipping your chin. The chin must physically pass over your shoulder pad.
The anatomy of the movement is critical because of the physical constraints of a hockey player's equipment.
Right, the gear gets in the way.
Think about a driver checking their blind spot. If you just shift your eyes without physically rotating your neck, your own car's B-pillar creates a massive obstruction.
Yeah, you might think you checked the lane, but there could be a semi-truck sitting right in that structural blind spot.
Exactly. On the ice, a player's blind spots are manufactured by their own gear. If you just flick your eyes left or right, all you get is a blurry smear of your own massive shoulder pads.
And the thick plastic frame of your helmet cage or your visor, right?
Precisely. Helmets fundamentally degrade your peripheral view. The neck physically has to do the work to bypass the equipment.
And the duration of this look matters just as much as the rotation. The playbook describes it as a quick snapshot, absolutely not a prolonged stare.
Taking a photograph is the perfect way to conceptualize it. You are taking a high-speed photograph of the ice to process in your brain's working memory after you turn back.
You are not reading a novel out there.
No. If you stare, two catastrophic things happen. First, you lose track of the puck, and the puck is the one object that dictates the entire flow of the game.
Right, you can't lose the puck. What's the second thing?
This is a subtle but massive issue. A prolonged stare almost always costs a player a stride.
The deceleration problem.
Exactly. If you slow your feet down to look around, you are conditioning your own brain to hate scanning.
Because your brain associates looking with losing speed.
Yes. Your brain will eventually conclude correctly that looking around makes me slow and vulnerable, so you will subconsciously stop doing it.
So a proper scan must occur while gliding, or while crossing over, or transitioning backward. It can never interrupt the kinetic chain of your skating.
That is vital, and the absolute golden rule of this physical mechanic, the period at the end of the sentence, is that the very last look is always, always back at the puck.
I want to dive into the timeline of this, the actual why behind the habit,
Yeah.
because understanding why this specific sequence of mechanics matters so much really highlights the gulf between an amateur and a pro.
It's all about sequence.
Let's look at how a beginner processes receiving a pass. A beginner sequence goes like this. First, they receive the puck on their stick. Second, they look up to see what's happening. Third, they decide what to do. Fourth, they act, meaning they pass or shoot.
And that entire sequence takes well over a full second, probably closer to a second and a half.
Which, at the speed of hockey, is an absolute eternity.
It is a death sentence for your possession time. Let's do the math on that second and a half. An average professional forechecker is skating at, conservatively, 20 miles per hour. That is roughly 30 feet per second. If you take a second and a half to receive, look, decide, and act, a forechecker who was 45 feet away when the puck hit your stick is now physically driving their shoulder into your chest.
Wow. So the beginner actively invites pressure by waiting to look until the puck is already on their stick.
Because when the puck is on your stick, cognitive processing time is suddenly very expensive. You are paying for it with the limited space you have left.
That is a great way to put it. Now look at the master sequence. It is the exact same four actions, but completely reordered.
Look. Decide, receive, act.
Look, decide, receive, act. This reordering is completely free, and it alters the physics of the game. The puck's arrival should be the trigger for an action, not the starting gun for a decision process.
Let's put the listener right in the middle of this to really cement it. Imagine you are a winger positioned on the half wall in your defensive zone.
Okay, I'm visualizing it. My back is to the boards.
Right. A defenseman goes back behind your own net, recovers the puck, and fires a hard pass up the wall toward you. That puck is going to take maybe 1.5 to 2 seconds to reach you.
So that 1 to 2 seconds of flight time is the highest value time in hockey.
It really is. You have absolutely nothing else to do with your eyes. The puck's trajectory is locked. It's not going to suddenly change its mind in midair. So information gathered while the puck is coming is basically free.
So during that flight time, you execute a pre-scan, you snap your chin over your inside shoulder, you take your photograph,
Yep.
and in that snapshot, you see your center flying up the middle of the ice. You also see the opposing defenseman pinching down the wall, closing in on you fast.
So you turn your head back to the puck.
Now, in the remaining half second before the puck hits your tape, you have to do something crucial. You have to name your options.
Naming the option is what solidifies it into a commitment. If you just have a vague sense of, oh, maybe I'll pass, you will hesitate.
So you have to explicitly name your first option in your internal monologue. You think, center up the middle.
But the true hallmark of a high IQ player is that they simultaneously name a bailout plan.
Like a plan B.
Exactly. They think center up the middle. If no, chip off the glass.
Having that plan B is the ultimate antidote to panic. I love this part of the source material. Panic isn't a personality flaw. Panic is simply what happens to a human being when they run out of options mid-play while under physical threat.
That's all it is. If your plan A collapses in the final fraction of a second before the puck arrives,
Like maybe that center gets tied up.
exactly. You don't freeze. You just instantly execute the bailout plan. You chip it off the glass.
And from the stands, the fans think, wow, that player is so calm, so quick. Their hands are incredible.
But their hands aren't actually faster than the beginner's hands. Their brain was faster because they did their thinking when it was free.
That makes so much sense. And this requires a level of humility too, right?
Oh, absolutely. The playbook emphasizes that you have to let your final glance overrule your grand plan.
So you might have seen a beautiful cross-ice pass developing during your pre-scan. But if your final look right before the puck arrives reveals a defender sliding into that lane, you have to accept that your plan went stale.
You instantly pivot to the bailout. A second best play made instantly is almost always better than the perfect play made a second too late.
Especially when holding onto the puck for that extra second means a 210-pound opponent is going to separate you from your consciousness.
Exactly. So what should we remember here? The foundational mental model is the shift in sequence. Information gathered after the puck arrives is paid for in blood and possession time. Look, decide, receive, act.
Okay, so that establishes the theory and the mechanics. But it's one thing for us to sit here and say looking early makes you better. It's another thing entirely to prove it scientifically.
We need the data.
Let's get into the hard data, because this is where a lot of conventional sports wisdom gets taken to the woodshed. The playbook breaks down a major 2025 research study by Berg and colleagues, published in the Journal of Sports Sciences.
And this wasn't a bunch of college kids running drills in a lab.
No. The researchers hand-coded 22 televised games from the top Swedish men's and women's professional leagues, the SHL and SDHL. They tracked 88 professional players and meticulously analyzed 2,545 individual puck receptions.
The methodology they used is vital to understand because it reflects the unique, chaotic demands of hockey. They established a strict 5-second window right before the puck reception to count the scans.
Why specifically 5 seconds?
Because anything you looked at 6 or 7 seconds ago in hockey is obsolete data. Players move too fast.
That makes sense.
Furthermore, they defined a scan rigorously. It had to be a clear head movement, turning the face away from the puck, and it had to be held for at least 0.2 seconds. No eye flicks, no microglances.
So after grinding through over 2,500 receptions by elite pros, what did they find? Players took a mean of 1.48 scans in that 5-second pre-reception window.
That averages out to roughly one scan every 3.4 seconds. Keep that number in mind. One scan every 3.4 seconds.
Because here's the stat that genuinely made my jaw drop. Out of all those receptions by elite, highly paid professional hockey players, in 39% of those receptions, the player didn't scan at all.
Zero scans.
Nearly 40% of the time, pros are receiving the puck completely blind to what is behind them.
It sounds absurd until you realize how incredibly difficult the game is physically. But the counter stat is where the gold is.
Let's hear it.
When those same players did manage to scan at least once, their success rate on their next action, meaning they made a successful pass, shot, or controlled carry, jumped from 70.1% to 78.8%.
That is nearly a 9 percentage point bump just from physically turning your chin over your shoulder.
It's massive.
In a sport where a 1% advantage can be the difference between winning a championship and getting relegated, an 8.7% bump is astronomical.
What gives this study so much credibility is how the researchers controlled for covariates.
Explain covariates for us really quickly.
Covariates are all the other messy variables in a live game that might explain the success rate instead of the scanning.
Oh, like maybe they just had an easier pass to make.
Exactly. For example, they looked at close combat, which is body contact right around the moment of reception. They also looked at opponent pressure, which they defined as an opponent being within one stick length.
And obviously, if you have no pressure on you, your pass is more likely to succeed.
Right. Statistically, escaping close combat and finding unpressured space are actually slightly more predictive of a successful play than the scan itself.
Okay, so does that mean scanning isn't that important?
No, this is where the critical thinking comes in. How do you find unpressured space in the first place?
You scan.
You scan. Scanning is the behavioral mechanism that physically allows you to navigate into the low pressure zones where your success rate skyrockets to nearly 80%.
Okay, I have to push back here. Because if scanning is this incredibly powerful tool, it brings up a massive contradiction with how the sport is taught.
I know exactly where you're going with this.
If you go down to the local rink and listen to a hockey clinic, coaches are screaming until their voices are hoarse. Keep your head on a swivel. Scan every 1 to 2 seconds. They treat the neck like a metronome.
It's true.
But this Berg data proves that actual measured professionals in top leagues only scan once every 3.4 seconds. And 40% of the time, they just don't do it at all. Are the coaches completely wrong?
It is a fascinating disconnect between coaching pedagogy and empirical reality. The source material addresses this head on. The coaching benchmark of a scan every 1 to 2 seconds is, frankly, completely unsupported by the hockey data.
So it's just a myth.
If a player actually hit that metronome rate, they would be scanning 2 to 3 times as frequently as the measured professional average. It seems impossible to maintain while actually playing the physical game.
Yeah, you'd be getting hit constantly.
Now, a coach might defend themselves by saying, well, I'm talking about general off-puck play, when the player is just skating around, not the 5 seconds right before they get the puck.
But does that defense hold up?
It falls apart logically. The 5-second pre-reception window is the highest leverage time in the entire sport.
Mm.
If pros aren't hitting that metronome rate when it matters the most, the coaching benchmark is a myth.
It might be a useful exaggeration, like a way to overcorrect players who never look up, but it is not a scientifically validated target. You don't need to be a frantic owl out there.
I think to really understand why hockey players don't and physically can't scan constantly, we have to look across to other sports.
Oh, yes. The playbook brings in some incredibly famous football or soccer for North Americans. Studies by Jordaek and Aksum. These are the studies that basically started the whole sport scanning revolution.
Right. In the English Premier League, top midfielders average about 0.44 scans per second. That is roughly 3 scans every 10 seconds.
But the Aksum study went further by using eye-tracking glasses on elite footballers. And they found something completely counterintuitive.
The footballers actually spent the vast majority of their visual fixation time staring directly at the player who had the ball.
They anchor on the ball carrier, and they just take lightning-fast peripheral snapshots of the space around them. Actually, space was the least fixated category in their visual diet.
So why doesn't that soccer scanning behavior translate perfectly to a sheet of ice?
Well, the playbook points out several massive structural reasons. First is the sheer geometry and physics of the playing surface. A hockey rink is a tiny claustrophobic box compared to a massive football pitch.
And ice allows skaters to move significantly faster than runners on grass. This means the visual photograph you take in hockey goes stale incredibly fast.
Right. In soccer, a scan from 4 seconds ago might still give you a rough idea of where the defense is. In hockey, a scan from 4 seconds ago is ancient history. The entire play has reversed direction twice since then.
The locomotion is totally different, too. Soccer players generally run forward or laterally. Hockey defensemen spend half the game skating backward.
Yeah, hockey defensemen retreating backward into their own zone already has the entire play unfolding in front of them. Their blind spot is completely behind them, which is a totally different biomechanical scanning challenge than a midfielder scanning 360 degrees.
Furthermore, hockey has line changes on the fly. You might take a snapshot of 5 opposing players, and 10 seconds later, 3 of them have jumped over the boards and 3 completely different fully rested players are rushing at you.
And finally, the boards. A soccer pitch has boundaries where the ball goes out of play. A hockey rink has curved walls that keep the puck in play and can be used to bank passes. The geometry of your options includes the vertical plane of the glass.
So what does all this data mean for you, practically? What's fascinating here is the absolute biggest takeaway from the Berg study isn't about maximizing your scans, it's about the threshold.
The threshold, meaning?
Going from 0 scans to just 1 single solitary scan in that 5-second window is what provides the massive 8.7% bump in success.
There is zero evidence in the data that cranking the dial from 2 scans up to 4 or 5 scans gives you any further advantage.
Exactly. It's a binary threshold. You just need to clear the baseline of getting 1 good early piece of information.
So if I'm tracking all this, the golden rule isn't about scanning like a maniac. It's deliberate. We know how to look, and we know why the data says it works.
Now we need the priority checklist.
Because if you just whip your head around and stare at the chaos, you haven't actually gathered information. You've just made yourself dizzy.
Mm-hmm.
When exactly do we execute these scans, and what are we looking for?
Let's start with when. The baseline is that 1 to 3 seconds before receiving the puck. But there are highly specific contextual moments where a scan is mandatory. Let's talk about the back check.
Okay, so your team loses the puck in the offensive zone and you are racing back to your own defensive zone to stop a rush. What does the average player do?
They stare laser holes into the back of the opposing puck carrier.
Right, because that's the threat. The puck is the threat.
It feels like the threat. But if you fixate entirely on the puck carrier while skating back, you arrive in your defensive zone with absolutely zero situational awareness. You have no idea who came back with you.
So what should you do?
On a back check, you must look over your inside shoulder, the shoulder closer to the middle of the ice, at least twice, and you are deliberately not looking for the puck.
You're counting the bodies.
You are counting the opponents rushing up with you.
Because if you don't count them, you end up doing what we see in beer leagues every night. 3 guys aggressively defending empty ice in the corner, while an opposing trailer drifts into the slot completely uncovered, receives a drop pass, and scores.
It happens all the time. Another mandatory when is immediately after you make a pass.
Oh, this is a hard one.
The human reflex makes us want to admire our own work. You feather a beautiful saucer pass to your winger, and you just glide there watching to see if they catch it.
You have to break that reflex.
The millisecond the puck leaves your stick blade, you are an off-puck player again. Your new job is to find open space to support your teammate, and you cannot map that new space if you are admiring your pass.
Now let's talk about what the playbook considers the most dangerous reception in the sport, receiving the puck on the half wall.
As we discussed earlier, your back is to the middle. Half of your physical escape routes are blocked by solid wood and tempered glass, and one of your blind sides is completely behind you.
The tactical recommendation here is two looks. An early look to identify your options, and a late look right before the puck arrives to see if those options survive this shifting defense.
But we have to pause the tactical discussion right here. The playbook introduces a crucial override at this moment.
Yes, the source material heavily emphasizes this, and it really shifts the tone. This is the single most important safety rule in the entire sport, and it supersedes everything else we're talking about today.
Because looking over your shoulder to find a pass does absolutely nothing to protect your spine from a 220-pound player who is trying to violently separate you from the puck.
Vision is tactical. Position is survival.
A wall reception is fundamentally a reception into head-on contact with the boards. The absolute law of physics on the ice is this. You must never take a hit with your back squarely facing the boards. And you must never, ever duck your head.
This is exactly how catastrophic spinal injuries and broken necks occur. A player sees the pressure coming at the last second, they panic, they turn their back hoping the ref will call a penalty, and they get driven headfirst into the dasher board.
It's terrifying. To survive a wall reception, you must get your skates parallel to the wall. You want to take the kinetic energy of the contact on your forearm, your bicep, and your hip.
Your head must be up, and your chin must be off your chest to allow your neck muscles to brace.
Do not take the impact on the point of your shoulder. That's how you snap a collarbone, and definitively never on your back.
And what if the play develops so fast that you are already facing the glass, the pass is in your feet, and you physically cannot rotate your skates parallel in time?
If you are caught dead to rights facing the glass, your fallback survival mechanism is to get your stick and both gloves up against the glass and spread your entire body out as flat and wide as possible against the boards.
You are trying to distribute the force of the impact across the maximum possible surface area.
With absolutely zero gap between your face and the glass so your neck doesn't whiplash. Safety first, always. You cannot process hockey IQ from a hospital bed.
Okay, assuming we have positioned ourselves safely parallel to the boards, let's get back to the cognitive checklist. We take that snapshot over our shoulder. The ice is a blur of 10 players moving at high speed.
What exactly are we filtering for?
The playbook provides a strict 4-point priority order. Priority number one, pressure.
You need to extract 3 pieces of data about the pressure immediately. Who is closest? How fast are they coming? And crucially, what side are they approaching from?
Why does the side matter more than the raw distance?
Because it dictates your mechanical options. If a forechecker is angling toward your forehand side, they are deliberately taking away your strongest, most accurate play.
Right.
If they arrive on your backhand side, your strong hand is still free to make a play toward the middle. Their speed dictates your countdown clock. A defender gliding 10 feet away gives you drastically more processing time than a defender taking hard crossovers 15 feet away.
And their angle tells you their intention, right?
Exactly. If they cut off the middle of the ice, their goal isn't just to hit you. Their goal is to pin you against the boards. A high IQ player recognizes that steering angle and immediately plans an escape route to the exact area the pressure is trying to leave open.
Okay. Priority two, outlet options. Once you know where the threat is, you need to know where the puck is going next. You need to map 3 distinct routes in your head.
First, your primary option. That's the ideal, aggressive play that advances the puck.
Second, your support option, usually a center swinging low or a defenseman behind you for a quick pressure release safety valve.
And third, your safe out. The safe out is your emergency parachute. It might be rimming the puck hard around the glass to the neutral zone or just chipping it high off the boards to clear the zone.
If you map your safe out before the puck arrives, panic is eliminated from the equation.
Priority three, danger. This isn't danger to you physically. It's danger to your team on the scoreboard. It's asking the question, if I bobble this puck and turn it over right now, who scores?
This usually applies in your own defensive zone. You are looking for the opponent parked at the net front or the winger sneaking into the high slot, that prime shooting real estate right between the face-off circles.
A beginner gets entirely mesmerized by the puck battle in the corner. An expert keeps their body anchored toward the puck, but they constantly throw snapshots to the net front to ensure nobody is lurking in the lethal zones.
And finally, priority four, space. Where is the open ice that nobody is currently occupying?
The playbook puts this last because it's the only variable you can afford to misread without immediately giving up a goal or getting physically crushed. But identifying that open space is what elevates a competent, safe player into a lethal, offensive playmaker.
Let's also extrapolate on a hidden goldmine of situational awareness that the source mentions. Stoppages in play.
Oh, this is fascinating. Because what do 95% of players do when the referee blows the whistle?
They stop, they put their hands on their knees, they stare at the rafters, or they skate over to yell at the ref. It's completely dead time.
But for the elite players, a whistle is a buffet of free information. They are actively scanning the environment while everyone else is resting. They look at the opponent's bench. Who is jumping over the boards? Is the opposing coach deploying their top scoring line to exploit a mismatch?
Which defenseman is coming out? Is it their slow, heavy, stay-at-home guy or their fast, agile, puck-moving guy?
If it's the slow guy, the elite forward immediately registers, I can beat him wide with speed on this next shift.
They're also checking geography. Where is your own bench relative to the face-off dot? Do you have the long change in the second period? What is the score and exactly how much time is left on the clock?
Using the whistle to download this metadata separates the truly high IQ players from the guys who just use whistles to catch their breath.
So if we pull all of Section 3 together, our framework of observation is a strict checklist. Look early, especially on back checks, wall receptions, and stoppages.
Prioritize what you see. Pressure first, option second, danger third, space fourth. And let position, not vision, protect your spine on the boards.
Which transitions us perfectly into the next major conceptual leap. Because up to this point, we have only been talking about scanning. Scanning is essentially taking inventory.
It's figuring out where things are at this exact moment.
But hockey is dynamic. To be elite, you have to transition from scanning to anticipation. You have to figure out where things are going. And to do that, you have to learn how to read the biomechanics of the human body.
This is where the physics of deception comes into play. Because human beings in a competitive environment are chronic liars.
Right. An attacking puck carrier will violently drop their left shoulder, snap their eyes toward the corner, wind up like they're going to shoot, and then just effortlessly slide the puck between your legs and blow past you on the right.
If you just look at where their body is pointing, you get humiliated.
How do you separate the signal from the noise? The playbook introduces a brilliant concept here called the honest signal.
The honest signal is rooted deeply in biomechanics. The playbook references two fascinating studies by Brault in 2012 and Lynch in 2019. These researchers didn't actually study hockey. They studied deceptive sidesteps in rugby.
Oh, wow. Why rugby?
They wanted to know why defenders fall for fakes and how the best defenders don't. They discovered that the center of mass, specifically the chest and the hips, moving laterally, is an honest mechanical requirement to change direction.
Because of the laws of physics. You physically cannot shift 200 pounds of body weight in a new direction without moving your core mass in that direction first.
Exactly. The chest and hips cannot lie. However, a player can throw their head, their shoulders, their hands, and their stick in entirely fake directions without ever committing their actual momentum.
The extremities are incredibly cheap to move energetically.
So the head and the hands are the tools of deception. An attacker spends zero physical capital to execute a head fake, but if you, as the defender, bite on that fake and shift your weight, it costs you your entire positional advantage.
Therefore, the defensive rule is simple. Ignore the extremities. Put your eyes squarely on the logo on the carrier's chest or on their belt buckle.
You do not need to stare at the puck on their stick. Your peripheral vision is more than capable of tracking a high-contrast black object on white ice. Read the core.
Now, the 2019 Lynch study adds a really important layer of nuance to this. It found that just tracking a floating center of gravity isn't quite enough for elite anticipation. We do need some local specific cues, like foot placement, to confirm the read.
Yes, the mental model here is that we must weigh the physical cues. You always weigh the core of the body infinitely heavier than the extremities, but you use the feet to confirm the core's intention.
If an attacker's hips are rotated to the right and their outside left skate blade aggressively bites into the ice, they are mechanically irrevocably committed to going right.
They cannot fake that without falling over.
How does this honest signal concept apply to reading a passer? Because predicting a pass feels slightly different than predicting a body movement. A pass involves projecting an object to a specific target through space.
Passes are actually much easier to anticipate than body movements because the biomechanics of accurately projecting an object are very rigid. What are the honest signals of a passer? First is the front shoulder.
The vast majority of passes go precisely where the front shoulder is pointing.
You physically cannot generate a hard, accurate, flat pass across your own body without squaring your shoulders up to the target lane.
Next is the micromechanic of the stick blade angle. This is such a subtle detail, but it gives away everything. If the passer's blade is open, meaning the heel of the stick is down on the ice and the face of the blade is rolled back slightly facing the ceiling, that puck is going to lift.
Right. That mechanical setup guarantees a saucer pass or a chip off the glass. It tells you the puck is going airborne. Conversely, if the blade is closed, cupping the puck, and aimed squarely at a passing lane, that flat lane is about to be utilized.
And then there are the eyes. At almost every level of hockey below the absolute elite top-tier professional leagues, players will stare at their target for a full second before passing to it. Their eyes are an honest signal.
But the elite counter to that is the look-off.
The Patrick Mahomes or Nikola Jokic move. Looking intensely to the left side of the ice while firing a 90-mile-an-hour no-look pass to the right tape.
And encountering a look-off actually tells you something profound about the player you are defending. If a player can stare at one option and pass accurately to another, it means two things.
What are they?
First, they are deliberately trying to manipulate your defensive structure. Second, they can only execute that manipulation if they already scanned the ice earlier and have a perfect mental map of where everyone is.
They did their homework early.
Precisely. When you realize you are defending a master of the look-off, you have to instantly adapt. You stop reading their eyes entirely, you treat their eyes as a deceptive extremity, and you revert back to reading the heavy, honest signals.
The angle of their shoulders and the tilt of their blade.
And the reverse is also true, which is a great cue for a defender. If an opposing player receives a pass, and you know they didn't scan beforehand, maybe they were fumbling with the puck, they have to look before they pass.
They are flying blind.
That is your immediate cue as a defender to jump them with extreme pressure because they need an extra cognitive beat to map the ice, and they are going to heavily telegraph their eventual pass because they are processing under duress.
So the essence of anticipation through physics is this. We read the honest signals, the chest, the hips, the blade angle, because physics demands they align with the action. We actively ignore the deceptive signals, the head, the hands, the eyes of a master, because they are traps designed to pull us out of position.
All right, let's zoom out. We've gone from the micromechanics of turning your head to the biomechanics of a shoulder dip. Now we need to look at the macro.
Reading individual bodies is necessary, but elite anticipation requires understanding the structural context that those bodies are operating within. We need to read systems, and we need to read the rule book.
Let's start with systems, specifically reading pressure on a forecheck. A forecheck is the organized system an opposing team uses to pressure you deep in your own defensive zone to force a turnover.
Forechecks are not random chaos. They have highly defined geometric shapes. If you can recognize the shape as it develops, you know exactly where the pressure will arrive before it gets there.
The roles in a forecheck are categorized as F1, F2, and F3. These aren't specific players. They are functional roles defined entirely by the order in which they arrive in the zone.
The most common system a player will face is the house default, the 2-1-2 forecheck. Two forwards pressing deep, one forward high in the slot, and two defensemen holding the blue line.
If you glance over your shoulder and recognize the 2-1-2 structure forming, you immediately know that two heavy bodies are coming at you fast from two converging directions.
F1 attacks the puck carrier directly, taking the body. F2 attacks the puck carrier's most obvious passing outlet, usually sealing off the strong side wall. So if you know this system is bearing down on you, what is the geometric escape route?
It has to be behind the net. You reverse the puck to your defensive partner, or you wheel around the net yourself because you logically know that F1 and F2 just vacated that space to come attack you. You use the system's own momentum against it.
Exactly. But contrast that aggressive pressure with a 1-3-1 trap set up in the neutral zone.
In a 1-3-1, one forward gently steers, three players form a horizontal wall across the middle of the ice, and one defenseman stays back. If you are a defenseman retrieving a puck against a 1-3-1, suddenly there is almost no pressure on you deep in your corner.
It feels incredibly peaceful. You have all this time and space.
But it's total bait. It's a psychological trap.
It is entirely bait. The trap wants you to feel comfortable, so you try to make a standard breakout pass up the wall. but the wall is heavily covered by that layer of three players, and the middle is completely clogged.
If you try to force a regular pass, it is a guaranteed catastrophic turnover.
So what is the anticipatory read against the trap?
The read is to use the space they are giving you. You skate the puck up the ice with speed to force one of those three players in the middle layer to step out and commit to hitting you.
Once they commit, the trap structure is broken and a passing lane opens.
Or you bypass the layer entirely by chipping the puck into the offensive zone. A truly high IQ player identifies the opponent's system on the very first shift of the game, comes back to the bench, and tells the entire unit so everyone can pre-decide their breakout geometry before they even step back on the ice.
This brings us to one of my absolute favorite parts of this playbook, using the official rulebook as a tactical weapon.
It's brilliant.
I always thought of the rulebook as just a list of things that get you sent to the penalty box. But the playbook argues that the rules actually dictate the physical reality of the game and therefore dictate what you should anticipate. Let's look at the icing rule.
When a team ices the puck, shooting it from behind the center red line all the way down past the opponent's goal line without it being touched, play stops. The faceoff comes all the way back deep into the offending team's defensive zone.
But the critical tactical element is that under NHL and International Ice Hockey Federation rules, the team that iced the puck is legally barred from making a line change. They cannot substitute players, and they cannot use their timeout to rest.
There are a few tiny exceptions, like if a player's equipment breaks or the goalie is injured, but essentially, those exact five skaters are legally trapped on the ice.
So if you are the attacking team stepping up to take that offensive zone faceoff, your anticipation changes entirely based on your knowledge of that rule.
You know for a physiological fact that you are facing a defensive unit that is accumulating lactic acid. They are exhausted, their heart rates are maxed out, and their cognitive processing is slowing down.
Your anticipation should be to run an incredibly aggressive, heavy pressure forecheck, because exhausted players make panic decisions under pressure. You use the rule book to predict the physical state of your opponent.
But, and this is a massive distinction for our listeners playing in the States, USA Hockey rules are different.
Very different. Under USA Hockey, Rule 624 does not attach a substitution prohibition to an icing infraction. The team that iced the puck simply gets to skate off and deploy a fresh line.
If you try to run an aggressive, exhausting forecheck, assuming they are tired under USA Hockey rules, you're going to get burned by five guys with totally fresh legs. The rules literally dictate the physical reality of the moment.
If we expand on reading rules as tactics, it applies incredibly heavily to the net front. Let's look at the dynamic between reading a shooter and a goalie screen. If you are a shot-blocking defenseman, what honest signals tell you a heavy shot is coming?
We go back to the mechanics. Hands wide apart on the stick with the bottom hand gripping low on the shaft means the player is preparing to put their body weight into the flex of the stick. It's going to be a heavy slap shot or a loaded wrist shot, and it takes a fraction of a second to load.
Hands close together up near the top of the stick means a quick, deceptive snapshot or a pass.
But what if you are the goaltender and there is a 230-pound forward standing directly in your line of sight? How does the rulebook dictate your anticipation?
The playbook dives into Rule 69, which governs interference on the goalkeeper. Screening a goalie, which means standing completely outside the blue paint of the goal crease, directly in their sight line, without making physical contact, is 100% legal in the NHL and the IIHF.
Rule 69.1 focuses on disallowing goals, primarily if an attacker physically impairs the goalie or enters the goal crease.
So if an attacker is legally planted 2 inches outside the blue paint, the goalie cannot just stand in the middle of the net blind, complaining to the referee and hoping for a whistle. The referee is not going to blow the whistle.
Exactly. The goalie's anticipatory framework must be, this screen is entirely legal. I am on my own. I have to actively fight through this and move my head around this body to track the puck, or I am going to get scored on.
But again, the rulebook variations are wild. Under USA Hockey, Rule 625 is much stricter. It essentially allows a referee to void a goal if an attacking player is simply standing in the crease area, regardless of whether they made contact, assuming the puck wasn't in the crease first.
Knowing these exact jurisdictional boundaries changes where forwards are willing to stand, which changes where the goalie has to look, which ultimately changes where the puck is going to end up.
And anticipating where the puck is going to end up brings us to what the playbook calls the ultimate form of anticipation. Reading the play's next state based on the physics of the environment, rather than just tracking the players.
This is a profound shift in mindset. A puck rimmed hard around the glass follows the curve predictably and usually pops out near the point. A soft rim dies in the corner.
But the most important application of this physics-based anticipation is in physical battles. Let's say you are racing an opponent toward the corner for a loose puck. You realize in a fraction of a second that you are arriving slightly second, you are off balance, and your opponent is bigger and already has superior body positioning.
Mathematically, you are going to lose the initial battle for that puck.
A beginner insists on trying to win a battle they have already mathematically lost. They lunge, they swing their stick wildly, and they end up completely out of position while the opponent skates away with the puck.
A master reads the physics of the situation, concedes the initial battle, and immediately plays for the next state. They recognize, I can't get the puck, but I can tie up his stick, or I can position my body exactly where the puck is going to squirt out after he tries to control it.
Conceding a lost battle in order to win the second puck is the hallmark of elite anticipation.
Yeah.
You are anticipating the environment, not just the man.
So to summarize our contextual reads, forecheck systems tell you the geometry of where pressure is coming from. The rulebook tells you who is physically exhausted and where players are legally permitted to stand. And environmental physics tells you where the puck will bounce next.
Which leads us perfectly into the most critical, razor-thin distinction in this entire masterclass. We've talked endlessly about anticipation, but we have to distinguish it from guessing.
Because these two actions look absolutely identical on video when they work, and they look identical when they fail. This is why players and coaches confuse them constantly.
But internally, they are fundamentally opposite cognitive processes. Anticipation is acting on established information. Guessing is acting on hope.
That is the dividing line. And the playbook gives us the ultimate litmus test to tell them apart. It is a single piercing question you should memorize and ask yourself after every single shift.
What is it?
Would my physical position still be useful to my team if I turn out to be wrong?
Let's walk through a vivid, high-stakes scenario to illustrate this test. Imagine you are playing defense in your own zone. The opposing team has the puck on the right side boards. You see a passing lane opening up across the ice to an opponent sneaking back door on the left side.
You decide you want to jump that passing lane and intercept the puck.
Let's look at the anticipation version of this play first.
In the anticipation version, you have gathered information. You read the passer's shoulders squaring up. You see the stick blade is closed. You have a real physical cue. You aggressively shade your body toward the passing lane to intercept it.
But, crucially, you maintain your center of gravity and you keep your body positioned directly between the puck carrier and your own net. If the pass comes, you intercept it. But what if the pass never comes? What if the guy fakes it and holds onto the puck?
If he fakes it, you are still standing between him and the net. You haven't taken yourself out of the play. You are still actively playing defense. Your physical position is still incredibly useful to your team, even though your prediction about the pass was entirely wrong.
Now let's look at the guessing version. Same exact setup in the defensive zone. But instead of shading and maintaining your posture, you completely abandon your defensive positioning. You dive fully into the passing lane, totally committing your momentum.
You leave the ice between the puck carrier and your net completely empty. If the pass comes, great, you look like a hero on the highlight reel. But if the pass doesn't come...
If he holds it, you have just given the puck carrier a completely unimpeded red carpet lane directly to your goaltender. And you are standing out in no man's land, 20 feet away, doing absolutely nothing.
Your position is completely worthless because your guess didn't land. You acted on hope, and hope is not a defensive strategy.
And there is actually a physical signature to guessing that coaches look for. The playbook says reaching with your stick is the ultimate tell. If you have to lunge and reach out with your stick to try and tip a pass while your feet stay planted in cement, you guessed.
You were late to process the information. True anticipation means you read the play early enough to get your actual feet into the passing lane, maintaining your balance.
We also have to talk about the asymmetry of risk here, because where you attempt these plays dictates whether it's a smart anticipation or a reckless guess.
The geography of risk is crucial. If you jump a passing lane in the offensive zone and you completely miss, what is the worst consequence?
The opponent gets a breakout rush going the other way, but you have 150 feet of ice and hopefully your defenseman to recover and stop them. The risk is relatively low.
But if you jump a lane in your own defensive zone and miss, you instantly concede a point-blank grade-A scoring chance from the slot. The risk is catastrophic.
Therefore, the conditions for a valid anticipatory jump are extremely strict. You must have a real, verified physical cue. You must have defensive support behind you, covering the ice you are deliberately vacating. And ideally, you are executing this in the neutral or offensive zone.
If you are the last man back on defense, there is no mathematical version of jumping a passing lane that is worth the risk. Never do it. Just play the body. So that is the definitive boundary. Anticipation leaves you useful if you're wrong. Guessing leaves you useless.
We are nearing the summit of this framework. Intellectually, we understand the mechanics. We've debated the data. We have the observation framework. We know how to read the biomechanical cues. We understand the systems, and we know how to manage risk.
But knowing it is not the same as doing it at 20 miles an hour.
How do we actually wire this massive cognitive load into our nervous system so it happens automatically? We have to talk about training the brain. And the source material is brutally honest about the gatekeepers to this entire process.
The absolute precondition to everything we have discussed today is the head-up habit. If you have to physically look down at the puck on your stick blade to control it, you cannot scan the ice. It is a biological limitation. You cannot look down and up at the same time.
Head-up puck control isn't just some fancy stick handling trick for YouTube. It is the absolute non-negotiable entry requirement for hockey IQ. If your eyes are locked on your blade, every single tactic we've talked about for the last hour is totally unavailable to you.
Once the head is up, what we are really training is advanced pattern recognition. We hear people say that veteran players think the game faster, but neuroscience tells us that experience doesn't magically give a 35-year-old veteran faster twitch muscles in their eyeballs or faster synaptic firing rates than an 18-year-old.
Experience gives the veteran fewer things to think about. How does that work?
It happens through a cognitive process called pattern compression or chunking. When a beginner looks at a defensive zone, their brain sees 10 individual human bodies moving rapidly in 10 different chaotic directions.
It completely overwhelms their working memory. They freeze.
When a 10-year professional veteran looks at the exact same arrangement of 10 bodies, their brain does not see 10 individuals. Their brain compresses those 10 data points into a single recognized unit.
They see one concept, low to high prey developing. The details compress into a single recognized pattern, and that pattern already has an automatic physical response attached to it.
That compression is why instinct feels instantaneous. The pro isn't calculating, they are just recognizing.
But how do you deliberately accelerate that compression? You don't just want to tell a kid, play for 10 years and you'll get it. The playbook outlines some incredibly actionable training steps to build this circuitry. First, to build the head-up habit, you have to use a forcing function, not just willpower. You can't just tell yourself, I'll try to look up more.
Right. Willpower fails under stress. You need drills that physically force the eyes up. The playbook recommends getting a slide board or a wooden handling ball off the ice. You practice stick handling while a partner stands in front of you, holding up varying numbers of fingers or colored cards.
You have to actively call the numbers or colors out loud while handling the puck. If you look down at the puck, even for a microsecond, you fail the drill. 10 to 15 minutes a day of this discussion actively rewires how you use your peripheral vision.
The key is keeping the puck in the lower quadrant of your peripheral vision, keeping your hands away from your body so you aren't jammed up, and maintaining a soft grip so you can actually feel the vibration of the puck through the carbon fiber of the stick.
To train the pattern recognition aspect, you have to engage your verbal processing. Naming patterns out loud is the mechanism that commits them to long-term memory.
When you are sitting on the bench after a shift, don't just drink water and stare at the scoreboard. Say out loud to your line mate, hey, on that breakout, they had three guys heavily overloading the strong side, which left their weak side point completely wide open.
Naming the geometry out loud turns a vague, chaotic experience into a concrete, retrievable pattern. If you don't name it, the experience just evaporates from your short-term memory.
And you can do this while watching a game, too. Whether you're on the couch watching the NHL or in the stands at a junior game, practice predicting the play out loud. Say he's going to reverse it behind the net or she's going to shoot low for the far pad rebound.
As the source notes, being wrong is actually the most useful part of this exercise. A wrong prediction that you consciously notice, verbalize, and correct builds stronger neural pathways than a correct prediction you just silently kept in your head.
But the absolute best live game training method for anticipation is a specific viewing exercise. Go to an arena, pick one single player, ideally a center or a defenseman, someone who operates in traffic, and commit to watching only them for an entire shift. Actively ignore the puck entirely.
Which is incredibly hard to do. We are so conditioned by television broadcasts that dynamically follow the puck and crop everyone else out of the frame. TV ruins your ability to learn off-puck anticipation because it hides all the preparatory work.
Exactly. When you watch that one player live, watch where their head turns. Watch when they initiate a scan. Watch where they drift into open ice when they are completely uninvolved in the play. Watch how they map the pressure.
You will learn more about the mechanics of Hockey Sense in one single shift doing this live than you will watching an entire season of highlight reels on your phone.
We also have to address the modern tech angle. What about all these highly marketed off-ice cognitive trainers? Virtual reality headsets that simulate the ice? Or those light reaction boards where you tap the flashing buttons as fast as you can? Do they build hockey IQ?
They certainly have their place in training visual acuity, but we have to be realistic about their limitations regarding actual game sense. The playbook cites a fascinating 2025 study by Fortin Guichard. They took a group of elite 15 to 16-year-old players and ran them through heavy cognitive and VR testing to see if it predicted their actual on-ice hockey sense.
And what was the verdict?
The finding was unambiguous. The off-ice testing alone was not a perfect predictor of game sense. In fact, professional scouts, simply watching the players play actual hockey games, were more accurate in evaluating hockey IQ on their own than the high-tech tests were.
Because reacting to a flashing LED light on a board trains your eye-hand reaction time. It doesn't train you to read the geometry of a 1-3-1 trap.
Precisely. The highest predictive accuracy came from combining the scouting with the tech. Off-ice tools are a supplement. They isolate visual skills. But they are absolutely not a substitute for the embodied cognition of playing the game. To build hockey IQ, you have to play in small area, high decision density scenarios. 3-on-3 cross-ice games force you to read pressure, find options, and execute in tight spaces hundreds of times an hour.
So we have covered an immense landscape of information today. Let's pull this all together into our final mastery review. If you're going to walk away from this deep dive and step onto the ice tomorrow, or if you're going to teach this to someone else, here is the ultimate synthesis. If you only remember these core principles summary.
I will recap the first three foundational pillars. Number one, reframe your entire understanding of vision. It is not a magical innate gift. It is a highly trainable mechanical habit of turning your head early. Number two, permanently change your processing sequence. It must be look, decide, receive, act. Let the puck's arrival be the physical trigger for your action. Do not let it be the starting gun for your decision. And number three, keep the puck as your primary visual anchor, but use your pre-reception snapshots to gather information in a strict descending priority order. Pressure first, option second, danger third, space fourth.
And I'll synthesize the final three advanced principles. Number four. Deception is cheap, and it happens at the extremities. Ignore the head fakes. Read the honest biomechanical signals, the chest, the hips, the angle of the blade, over the deceptive signals. Number five, the golden test of anticipation versus guessing. If you jump a passing lane and you are dead wrong, is your physical position still actively useful to your team? If yes, you brilliantly anticipated. If you are stranded in no man's land and useless, you recklessly guessed. And finally, number six, the absolute physical override of the entire sport. Never, ever take a hit with your back facing the boards. Position is what protects your spine. Looking over your shoulder does not. Get your skates parallel and take the impact on your side.
When you look at this framework in its entirety, you realize it isn't just about hockey. It's a masterclass in how the human brain processes chaotic, high-speed, high-threat environments. It's about doing the heavy cognitive work early, when the cost of thinking is low, so that when the pressure spikes and the physical threat arrives, your execution is entirely automatic. You deconstruct the magic into cold mechanics, you drill those mechanics into subconscious habits, and eventually those habits look exactly like magic to everyone watching from the stands.
That is beautifully said.
And it actually brings us to a final, much broader thought to leave you with. We've spent this deep dive meticulously breaking down how elite hockey players train themselves to quite literally see the future. They do it by doing the work early. They observe the honest signals before the action actually happens. It really makes you wonder, in your own life, in your career trajectory, in your high-stakes conversations or your negotiations, how much of your time are you spending just watching the puck, just reacting in a panic to the loudest, most obvious crisis right in front of your face? And what incredible, invisible patterns would you unlock if you simply remembered to turn your head, read the honest signals, and scan the ice before the moment actually arrived? Keep your head up out there.